We're doing Parsha Summary. We're going to Parsha Vayigash. It's an honor to be here tonight after 3 weeks of being out of commission. Baruch Hashem, it's great to be back learning. I'm still on heavy antibiotics, but it's good to be able to get out and learn. So let's begin. Parsha Vayigash, as usual, we begin with Parsha Summary. We get an overview of the Parsha. In our Parsha, we are going to see how Yehuda steps forward towards the Egyptian king Yosef. He sees him as Sofnas Paneah. He's been giving them all this trouble. And he says, "Let me have a word with you, sir." And he says, let's recount what happened here. You asked us if we have a brother, we have a father. All we did was we wanted to buy grain, and we told you, yeah, we have an older father, we have a younger brother, we have another brother that died. You see, under pressure, Yehuda changes the story a little bit. And this little one's the only one that's left from that mother. And you told us, bring down that little one, I want to get a look at him, that's all you asked for. And we said, no, we can't bring him. If we bring him, he'll run into trouble. And you said, no, if you don't bring him, I don't want to see your face again. So when we went back, our father didn't want to send him. He said, you know, he's the only one left from that mother. And then he said, we need food. So, you know, our dad is really connected to this little one. This little one's 30 years old. Says, you know, when he sees that he's not around, so he's going to have a heart attack. He's not going to be able to swallow that. And I took responsibility for the kid. That if I don't bring him, I'll take responsibility till the end of time. So let me stay as a servant in place of my little brother who you caught red-handed with a stolen goblet, and let him go back with his brothers. How could I go up and see my father when the lad isn't with me? How could I see my father enter such a bad state? And when Yosef hears his brave brother Yehuda break down like this before him, Yosef can't contain himself. He says, get everyone out of here. And the room is empty. Yosef and his brothers. Yosef starts crying. He reveals himself to his brothers. They come forward. He tells them, I'm Yosef, your brother. They all start crying. He says, don't feel bad. God had a plan when he sent me down here so I should sustain you and the rest of the family and the world. And now go back, tell Dad that I'm okay, and he should stay here. I'll arrange for area, territory nearby, and I'll sustain him because this family is going to last another 5 years. And you see, it's me, it's Yosef. And then he cries on his brother Benjamin's neck, and he kisses his brothers, and he cries by them. And after this whole long speech, the brothers finally get their breath back. They could talk. And when Paro hears that Yosef's brothers come, Paro says, hey, that's great. Tells Yosef, tell your brothers, go back to Canaan, bring the families up here to Egypt. Yosef tells them, don't worry about all the little details. You guys just come quickly. And he gives them special gifts. He gives extra gifts to Benjamin, to his brother Binyamin, from the same mother. Sends his brothers and he tells them, don't fight on the way, whose fault it was that we run into this muck, that how did it end up that this whole story happened, just get home and come back. They come to Yaakov. Yaakov initially doesn't believe it when he sees those special Egyptian wagons that were sent by Yosef to bring him back. Yaakov gets his life back after 21 years in sorrow. He's back to himself. And before he leaves, he foresees that this is the beginning of the exile. So he goes up to Beersheba and he offers sacrifices, and God tells him, don't worry, I'm going to be with you. I'll go with you down to Mitzrayim and I'll bring you back. Yosef will take care of you. Yaakov comes down to Mitzrayim. We have an enumeration of the 70 people who went down to Mitzrayim. And Yosef goes out to greet him. Before Yaakov comes to Mitzrayim, he sends Yehuda in advance. We have a tradition, Yehuda was sent to establish yeshivas in Egypt. And Yosef leads the way to greet his father. And he takes some of his brothers. He tells him, go tell Pharaoh that you heard your jobs are shepherds, because the Egyptians, they serve the sheep as a god. They won't want you in their midst. They'll let you get away with staying in the land of Goshen. This way Pharaoh won't take you into his forces, because he'll realize you have a different belief, different faith, you're shepherds. leave you out of politics, which is in your best interest. So Pharaoh meets with Yaakov and asks him, "How old are you, old man?" Which is a funny question. We'll discuss that when we review it. Yaakov tells him, "I'm 130 years old. My days have been few and my days have been bad. I've suffered through these 130 years. And I haven't yet attained the days of my forefathers." And Yaakov gives Pharaoh a special blessing, which we have on tradition, that the blessing was that whenever Pharaoh would come to the Nile would rise to greet him. And with this blessing, in essence, the famine ended, because when Pharaoh could cause the Nile to rise, so then he caused the Nile to rise frequently enough that the people could plant and they could their crops would grow, and the famine basically ended. Yosef sustains his father, and obviously the famine didn't end so fast, because the Torah enumerates how Yosef gathered all the money in Egypt, and when they finished the money, Yosef told them, "If you want grain, so sell me your sheep, your cattle." So they sold them the cattle, and then their horses. And when they had nothing left, he said, "Sell me your lands." And then Yosef took every Egyptian and he moved them around. He said, "Now that I own all the property in Egypt, you guys don't have money." So he partitioned the land and he gave out the land for people to work. He only taxed them 25%. The rest he let them keep. He knew a basic principle in economics that if you want a person to work well, he has to have a vested interest in the produce. So he left them with 75%. And by moving all the people, he caused that his brothers weren't the only people who were in exile, so to speak. Now all the Egyptians had a new land. All the Egyptians had moved. And when Yosef sustained the land of Egypt, in truth, he gave immense power to Pharaoh, because now Pharaoh owned everything unequivocally. Everyone knew that everything was owned by Pharaoh, thanks to Yosef, which gave extra power to the monarchy. And the parasha ends with the fact that the Jews started flourishing in Egypt. So now let's review the parasha with a little bit more depth. And before we begin reviewing the parasha, we have to remind ourselves where the scene is holding when our parasha begins. What did we see at the end of last week's parasha? We have seen how 9 brothers came down to Egypt to buy food. And in coming down to Egypt, they had really vowed, "We're bringing back Yosef at any cost. We're going to buy him back." And now this new Egyptian prince, Sofnas Paneach, calls them in and says, "You guys are spies. Nowhere else do people come down themselves. Everyone sends their servants. How come it is that you have to send 9 people to buy goods for your families? Why couldn't you send 2 or 3 servants? Why are you yourselves coming in? Must be you guys are spies. Why do you come in through the different gates? You're checking out Egypt. Why are you traveling all around town for 3 days before you come to buy food? Must be you guys are trying to spy out the land. Why is it I find you all in brothels?" So they say, "No, we have a long-lost brother. We're looking for him. We couldn't find him in the land. We thought a good-looking guy like him is probably in the brothels." And Yosef says, "I don't buy it." He sends him into a pit for 3 days. Yosef himself had been in a pit for a while. And now, when the brothers are in the pit and they see that they got problems, they say, "Wait a second. This is all happening because of what we did to Yosef. The process is beginning," as we discussed last week. He takes them out. He says, "You know, I fear God." And say, "Elokim ani yarei." Now the brothers are scared. They're not dealing with an ordinary Egyptian king. This is a man that speaks about God. This is a man who says, "I fear God. I can't do this to you. You guys go home and bring food, but I'm taking one away." And he takes Shimon. And when they come back to Yaakov, Yaakov says, "Wait a second. How come the first time I had you guys together without Benjamin, 10 brothers, I send out Yosef, you come back missing Yosef. 9 brothers without Benjamin, you come back missing Shimon. I'm not sending Benjamin with you. I'm not sending Binyamin. What's going on here? Something's wrong." And we mentioned last week that there's more to it than that. Yosef was the one who was supposed to inherit the rights of the firstborn. Yosef was the one who was supposed to get double. When he went out to the brothers, he's bumped off. It would seem like the next in line is supposed to be Shimon. Now he's bumped off. So maybe they're thinking, we got to get rid of Binyamin. Yaakov says, well, I don't want to send Binyamin with you guys. So after time passes, Yehuda says, Dad, I'll take responsibility. What was Yaakov's concern? Yaakov had a tradition that any child that he loses during his lifetime, God, that's a sign from God that he's going to be taken to task in the world to come. And when he lost his first son, Yosef, he thought, that's it. I'm not going to get the world to come the way I thought. That's the first sign. So Yehuda comes to his father and he says, Dad, I'm taking responsibility in this world and the world to come. If something happens to Binyamin, whatever bad things you're worried happen to you, if you lose a son in this world, I'll take them. My responsibility. I'm taking responsibility in this world and the world to come. And when Yehuda says that, Yaakov reluctantly allows him to go down with Binyamin. Now, this family of Rachel, Yaakov had four wives. Rachel had Yosef and Binyamin. They don't do very well when it comes to traveling because Rachel died while she was traveling, and Yosef disappeared when he was traveling, and now Binyamin is going to travel, and Yaakov is very concerned. So Yaakov is spending the fitful nights while they're on the road, praying, worrying, what's happening to his Binyamin, what's happening to his children. When Yaakov had initially sent Yosef out to his brothers, Yaakov said, go see the welfare of your brothers, fix things between you guys. Yosef has a mission. When he comes to the brothers, they try to kill him. Ultimately, they sell him. He hasn't fulfilled his mission. Now, 21 years have passed, and the brothers are standing before him, and they say, we've come to redeem Yosef. We've come looking for our long-lost brothers. That's why we've been searching Egypt. And Yosef says, I don't believe it. Yosef wants to ensure that the brotherhood has been reestablished between the brothers, and Yosef knows that the unity of the Jewish people is integral, is essential, before the Jewish people can begin their exile, which is about to begin. And so when the brothers come before him, Yosef parties with them. Yosef tells them, here, take Shimon back. Oh, is this your younger brother? Is this Binyamin? He says, Binyamin, you come eat with me. And after they have this whole party the next morning, he sends them off, and he hides his goblet. He tells his men, you put that goblet in the sack of Binyamin. And as the brothers leave the city, they are so laden with food, Yosef tells them, after all the trouble I did you, you guys don't have to pay, here's your money back. I'm giving you food without weight, without measurement. You guys load their sacks as much as they can handle, send them out. And as they leave Egypt, suddenly Yosef's men chase after them, and they say, why'd you pay a sack like this? Why'd you steal a special goblet that he used in order to do his witchcraft to figure out who you guys are? Think he can't figure things out without that goblet? And the brothers say, what do you want from us? We didn't do anything. And they say, what do you mean? In the past you proved it. In the past you said you weren't spies. You proved it. You brought a younger brother. Just like you did back then, that's what we want you to do now. Prove it. Let's open up your sack. And they start checking brother by brother, and they know that they're going to find it by Binyamin. And they open up Binyamin's sack, and there's the goblet. And the brothers turn to Binyamin, and they say, you thief. You're just like your mother. Your mother died because she stole her father's trumpet. She stole her father's idol. And when Lavan caught up with us, Yaakov said, whoever stole those children is going to die. And even though your mother wasn't caught, why'd she die? Because ultimately she was the one who stole them. And you're just like your mother. And they started beating him up. They said, what'd you do to us? Yeah. Said, Binyamin, how could you do this to us? And Binyamin, of course this is one understanding. And Binyamin is silent as Binyamin's stone on the breastplate, Yosh Fei, which stands for the word Yesh Pei. He always had what to say and was always silent. Binyamin's strength was silent. While everyone else was bound by the vow not to reveal what happened to Yosef, Binyamin with his Ruach HaKodesh knew all along what happened with his long-lost brother Yosef. He named every one of his 10 children after Yosef. Every one of his children he named, he said, I have a brother out there who isn't participating in my life. He doesn't know when I'm getting married. He doesn't know when I'm having children. I have a brother out there that I have no contact with. Every child he named after what's happening with Yosef. But he didn't say a word to anyone. And so too, when the brothers pounce on him, he says nothing. And now they come back before Yosef, and they tell this Egyptian prince, what can we do? We know we did nothing wrong. Must be God is paying us back for what we did in the past. And Yosef says, truth, legally, I should do what you guys say. I should kill him and take you all as my slaves. But what do I gain from that? I don't need that. I'm taking him, he'll be my servant. You guys go up to your dad, everything's okay. And that's where the parsha ended last week. The brothers are standing there dumbfounded. Yosef has said, you guys are, you're right, I really could take you to death, take you all as my slaves and kill this little one, but I'm not going to do that. I'm taking him as a slave, that I'll gain from, you guys go back home. We have a replay. 21 years have passed. 21 years ago, the brothers had sold a brother for a few coins in order to buy themselves shoes. And now they're standing before a king who says, go home, no problem. Yehuda steps forward. And in Yehuda stepping forward, there are two understandings. One understanding, Tachanunim Yedaberash, when a person sees he's in trouble, he should know to beg. Sometimes a person has to know how to beg. And one understanding that our sages teach us is that Yehuda came forward to beg. He said, Be Adoni, I beg you, my master. Let me please say a few words before you. Let's recount what happened here. And he starts going over. He says, please don't get angry. I honor you like I honor the king, Paro. You asked us if we have a father or a brother. We told you we have an elder father. We have a younger brother. We told you that this younger brother lost his mother. You said, bring him down. I want to take a look at him. We said, we can't. The poor kid, the father, if he loses him, Yehuda's begging. Yehuda, who is second in command in the land of Israel, his father is king, and he's next in line, he's being brought down to his knees. And he's begging. And he says, you told us if we don't bring him, we shouldn't come. And believe me, if we had any alternative, we wouldn't have come, even though we had a brother here in bondage. We had Shimon here in bondage, and nonetheless, our father didn't want us to take this young one from him. And it reached a point where there was no more food. Only then, was our father willing to let him go. And even then, our father begged us. He said, you know, this is the only remnant I have from my wife. I lost my wife. I lost the other son I had from her. If I lose this one, it's like I lost all three in one day. And now if I come back, what's going to be with my father? Yehuda's begging. When he sees that the little one isn't with us, you know, we're going to cause our father to die in such agony. I took a personal responsibility for the kid. Let me be a slave in this place. That's one understanding. But there's another understanding. There are fantastic midrashim about this parasha. Some of them we quoted last year. You're welcome to listen to last year's class online. And you could open the midrash says. We're going to quote one of them. The midrash says, we know Yosef is Bechor Shoro. Yosef was given the rights of the firstborn when Yehuda sinned, and Yosef is compared to an ox. Yosef's strength is like the strength of an ox. And Yehuda is like a lion. And now we have the face-off between the ox and the lion. We have the two forces in Judaism, Yosef and Yehuda, which are two totally different forces standing against one another. Yosef is the force of sustenance. Yosef is Mashiach ben Yosef, the one who's supposed to bring back the basic physical aspects of the Jewish people. That's Yosef. And he's standing facing off Yehuda, who represents the Torah, who represents the kingship in Am Yisrael. And now they're facing off, these two forces within the Jewish people. And Yehuda steps forward and he starts talking. He says, you know, this kid's grandmother was detained for one night by Pharaoh. And he was punished, his whole house was punished. You be careful that you don't get punished. You know, his mother, you know why she died? Because my father let out a word out of his mouth. He said a simple curse. And she died. You be careful that you don't get cursed. And you know, two of us brothers just walked into Shechem and the city was destroyed, and that was when we were little. That was for a girl. You're taking a guy. You better be careful. Paro, he says, he doesn't keep his word. You don't keep your word. You let out a decree, you made it known throughout the land that whoever comes to Egypt to get food will leave peacefully. We came here, why aren't you letting us leave in peace? You're playing games, there are a lot of games going on here. There are games about the money, there are games about the brothers, what are we coming to marry your family? You have to know who our father is, who our brother is. What do we ask for? We want to buy food. Paro, we know he's looking for young males as improper thoughts. You must do the same thing. What interest do you have in this young, good-looking guy? Paro's king and you're second. You know what? Back in Israel, my dad's king and I'm second in command. If I take out my sword, I'm starting with you and I'm ending with Paro. You also tell them, what do you want? Yehuda says, I took personal responsibility. I co-signed for the kid. And Yosef says, well, why didn't you co-sign for that other brother that you sold? I see that you sold him, and then you didn't care about the pain you caused for your father 21 years. At which point Yehuda let out a roar and he said, how could I go back to my father without the kid? And Yosef said, come, let's fight it out. You talk, and I'll answer you. And Yehuda tells Naphtali, Naphtali, you're the quick one among us. Naphtali ayala shlucha. Naphtali is like a young goat, like a young ram who could run quickly. You go out and get back to me. Tell me how many markets, how many main thoroughfares are there in Egypt? Naphtali runs, comes back, he tells him there are 12. Yehuda says, guys, there are 9 of us. I'll take 3. You guys take the others. We'll finish off Mitzrayim right now. And Yosef tells him, Yehuda, Mitzrayim is not Shechem. Shechem, you guys were able to destroy, and the world went on taking. Today, the whole world is relying on Mitzrayim. If you destroy Mitzrayim, you're destroying the world. You can't do that. At which point, Yehuda said, you know, you've been playing games with us all along. First, he told us we're all spies. You said we came to see how the land is. You said we stole the goblet. I swear by my father, the elder, and you say you're a God-fearing person. When you take a vow, how do you take a vow? You swear by Pharaoh, by that Russia. Our sages say that Yosef did this purposely. Whenever he was saying something that wasn't 100% truthful, he'd say, I swear by Pharaoh, because he knew Pharaoh was a Russia. He knew that that wasn't worth anything. So Yehuda told him, he said, you know, if I take out my sword, I'll fill Egypt with cadavers. At which point Yosef said, you take out that sword, I'll wrap it around your neck. Yehuda said, if I open my mouth, I'll swallow you. Yosef said, you open your mouth, I'll stick some stone in it. Yehuda said, what am I going to tell my father? What am I going to do? Yosef told him, tell him that when a bucket drops into the well, then the rope follows. His mother, why did she die? She's the bucket. She died because she stole and she lied. She stole, that's why she died. He stole, that's why he was taken. What's the problem? Explain that to your father. Yehuda says, you're judging me untruthfully. Yosef said, what's untruthful? What do you want? Yehuda said, well, my mother, she stole to save her father from serving idol worship, his mother. This kid's mother stole, took the idols out of her father's house. She wanted her father to stop serving idols. So Yosef said, fine, but what's the excuse for stealing my goblet? What do you mean I'm lying? So Yosef said, you want to know what's an unfaithful case? What's a lie? The fact that you stole your brother. When you sold your brother, that's when you guys ruled improperly. Yehuda said, you know, fire is burning within me like it burnt when we had a problem with Shechem. What happened in Shechem? The prince of Shechem abducted their sister, and the city of Shechem did not fulfill the Noahide law of taking him to justice. And then the city of Shechem was responsible for taking him to justice, and so the city of Shechem was wiped out, because if Noahide does not fulfill the Noahide laws, then they're punishable by death. So Yehuda says, if you want this young, good-looking guy, must be you want him for Mishkav Zohar, you want him for improper things. And Noahides are not permitted to go male with a male. So that's the same flame that's burning within me. Yosef says, you know, I'll put out that flame that's burning within you. I think it's the same flame that was burning within you when you saw that prostitute at the side of the road not so long ago. So we read this and you think, oh, he's answering him. There was an halachic argument between them. Yehuda said, halachically, you guys are going to be deserving of death. You say you're a God-fearing person? Well, I can't understand why you want him more than me. Anything he could do, I could do better. Must be you're thinking things that are improper. That's why you want such a good-looking young guy. And Yosef said, no, Yehuda, you don't have a right to judge this case anymore. After what happened between you and Tamar, your daughter-in-law, you have to check yourself first. You don't have a right to judge this anymore. You can't see clearly. Back then, you guys were clean. Then you could judge Shechem. Right now, you can't judge. That's the fire of Tamar burning within you. After what happened between you and Tamar, you can't judge. Yehuda says, you know, I'm getting angry, and no one's going to be able to stand against me when I get angry. Yosef said, I will. Yehuda said, I'm going to go out, and paint the marketplaces of Egypt with blood. Yosef told him, you know, you guys are painters. I noticed that. You sold your brother, you painted his garment with blood, came back to your father, you said, he was gorged, he's wiped out. Now you want to paint Mitzrayim with blood. Yeah, you guys, you're good at that. Painting with blood. And then the brother said, that's it. It's not going to work. We'll have to get rid of Mitzrayim. At which point Yosef said, wait, I got to tell you something. And then Yosef took the risk of his life. He said, everyone leave. I want to stay alone with these men. Yehuda has already threatened him to kill him. The brothers are prepared to destroy the city of Egypt. And Yosef is saying, leave me alone with these men. He can't stand against 12. Our sages say that Yosef knew that he was risking his life. He knew that the second all the Egyptians left, his brothers could pounce on him and kill him. And no one in the world would know that he was Yosef. It would be all over, and no one would have known everything that happened. But Yosef said, I cannot shame my brothers. There was a plan in everything that Yosef did, as we discussed last week. Yosef is bringing the brothers to a point of recognition that they erred in the past, and that there has to be unity above all between the brothers. And now, they've reached that point. The brothers are willing to go to war against Egypt for one brother who seems to be guilty. They've reached the point they've had to reach. And now Yosef has to risk his life. He's going to be left alone with his brothers. And when everyone leaves the room, Yosef says, you know that brother you guys have been missing? I have him here in the palace. You want Yosef? I'll bring him. Brothers say, really, where is he? She says, just a second. Yosef, the son of Yaakov. Yosef, the son of Yaakov. And the brothers start looking around. Where's he going to come in from? And they look to the right, and they look to the left, and they look to the front, and they look to the back. Yosef says, where are you guys looking? He's right here. I am Yosef, son of Yaakov. At which point we have a tradition that the brothers, Pachani Shmatan, that's a term that Chazal used for the Jewish people at Sinai, that the Jewish people effectively lost their souls, they couldn't handle it. And it would seem over here also that Pachani Shmatan, if understood literally, it means that they died, they were resuscitated. We could understand it not literally, we could say they fainted, the brothers couldn't handle it. They stood there in shock. The brothers couldn't say anything. After 21 years, they're standing before him, and Yosef saying, it's me. I'm Yosef. Until now, Yosef was talking through an interpreter. Now Yosef's standing alone with his brothers, and he says, guys, talk your language, we don't need an interpreter. Speak Hebrew. I'm Yosef. And you know what? I love you. I'm your brother. And you know what? When you guys took me and sold me to Egypt, I loved you then too. Ani Yosef Achichem. I am Yosef, your brother. The word ach means attachment. In Halacha we have a term, kira'im, tears, she'inam mitachim, that cannot be reattached. The word ichui means attachment. Yosef tells the brother, I am Yosef achichen. I am Yosef, your brother. I am Yosef who is attached to you. Asher mechartemoti. That you sold me, and you know what? Even when you sold me, at the time that you were selling me, I was still your brother. I've always loved you. And that's why Yosef is saying you should know. Notice, Shifiyam Davarchen, look at how I'm talking to you. I'm speaking your tongue. I speak the language. I am Yosef. Kifiyam Davarchen, Kifi, just like what I'm saying, can maybe that's my heart. Just like you see Binyamin, who's standing over there in the back, when Yosef revealed himself to his brothers, he said, guys, you come forward. Binyamin, you stay back there. He didn't want to embarrass them in front of Binyamin either. Only the brothers were standing around him, and Binyamin was standing in the back. He said, just like, you know, Binyamin standing back there in the corner, you know him? I have nothing against him. He didn't sell me. So do you guys. No difference. I'm your brother. I love you. Yosef shows him his bris milah. Now, when the Egyptians wanted to buy food from Yosef, Yosef knew that the major problem in Egypt was that the people were having illicit relationships. There was incest. There was bad problems with this in Egypt. So the time of Ezekiel, the Navi Yecheskel says, there are like horses running after this. the problem in Egypt is rampant, that they're always running after women, and improperly. It's not like they're marrying these women, one after another's wife. So Yosef tells them, you guys want to buy food from me, you guys have to circumcise. And they say, no way. Why do they have to circumcise? Because when one circumcises, it minimizes the pleasure. It removes some of the pleasure that one has when one is with a woman. And Yosef knew that that's one of the ways that God gave us to control our yetzer. It's one of the ways that we can control ourselves, the bris milah. So Yosef tells the Egyptians, you guys want to buy food from me, you're going to have to circumcise. And he's hoping maybe this will help them move forward morally. And the Egyptians say, no way. So Yosef says, fine. So they think, okay, we'll get around this. They go to Pharaoh. They come to Pharaoh. They say, Pharaoh, this guy's crazy. You know what he wants us to do? Pharaoh says, well, why don't you guys have your own thing? He told you there's a famine coming. So the Egyptians say, well, we really stored grain, and it all rotted. So Pharaoh tells them, look, this guy's amazing. He must have said some kind of incantation, and he made all your grain rot. If you guys don't listen to him, he'll say something, and you'll all drop dead. So listen to him. So all the Egyptians didn't have a choice. They wanted to buy the grain, so they said, fine. So all of Egypt is circumcised, except for the very wealthy. So when Yosef calls his brothers, he shows them, I have bris milah, I'm like you guys. And I'm not one of the Egyptians. I didn't need to do bris milah in order to buy grain. Aside from which, we know that in bris milah there are two stages. There's the foreskin, and there's a skin underneath the foreskin. The ora priya, there's a membrane that covers the aver beneath the foreskin. And when one does a bris milah, so first we cut off the foreskin, and then we peel back that membrane. So this is a process that only Jews would do. Nowadays, non-Jews cut off the foreskin with the membrane. But historically, when the Ishmaelites, the Arabs, when they do bris milah, they don't remove that foreskin, that membrane, the ora priya. Only Jews do that. So Yosef told them, all the Egyptians, their bris milah, you could look at them, they still have that membrane. Look at me. I have a bris milah like you. It's done at 8 days old. I'm a Jew just like you guys. And I speak your language. And even though each one of these signs was not 100%, but we have a rule that when you have two signs that are not 100%, they equal the sign that is 100%. Because really, the fact that he spoke Hebrew well, there was a lot of commerce going on between Egypt and Israel. It makes sense that a leader of Egypt could speak Hebrew.
what is Pharaoh?
Good question. I don't know. Right. So according to that Medrash, there are those that want to say that maybe in Israel they weren't speaking Hebrew, they were speaking Armenian. Who knows? I don't know.
What about people in Israel be speaking Canaanite?
Oh, so that's what some want to say. Some Rishonim say that in Israel they weren't speaking Ivrit, but rather they were speaking Canaanite. The only problem is that the brothers are called Ivrim, which seems to indicate that they were speaking Ivrit. It does seem to indicate that way. That's a discussion. What language were they speaking? If really in the land of Israel they were not speaking Ivrit, Hebrew, and Yosef was able to speak Hebrew, and that's one of the reasons that would explain why Pharaoh didn't speak Hebrew, so that would also explain why it was a good sign.
People spoke Hebrew.
Well, if that was the spoken language, don't forget, Egypt and Israel are right near one another, and Israel is the crossroads. They want to get to Europe, to Asia. Everyone passed through Israel. It should have been a well-known tongue.
Yeah.
That's what the Ramban said. It's not my own thought. I'm quoting. 70 from the family of Yaakov. But you still have all the land of Canaan. That's the question. Did the Canaanites speak Hebrew or not? So we just got a rough picture of one medrash of what went on here between Yosef and his brothers. We have to ask ourselves a question. When Yehuda reviews the story, he reviews how Yaakov said, I don't want to send Binyamin down, because if I send him down, something bad will happen to him on the way. Now, we have a rule we derive from Tanakh. The Gemara says, Lo lama niftach adam piv lasatan. A person shouldn't open his mouth to Satan, so to speak. A person shouldn't say, I don't want this and this bad thing to happen to me. It's as though he's saying that will happen. The Gemara records that one person lost a relative, and another Amora came to visit him. When he came to visit him, he saw he didn't cut his nails. So he told him, don't you know that when you're in mourning, you're allowed to cut your nails? So he told him, if it would happen by you, would you cut your nails? And shortly thereafter, that Amora lost a relative. And when the first guy came to visit him, the one who had previously been sitting Shiva, came to visit him, so he took his nails and threw them at him. He said, don't you know you're not allowed to speak that way? He held him responsible. We say, Brit Kutala Shpatayim. There's a treaty with our tongue. God says, if you say something, that's one, bring it one step closer to happening. So how could Yaakov speak this way? Yaakov says, I can't send Binyamin down to Egypt, because if I send him down, something bad will happen. Well, yeah, if you say something bad will happen, then we have a tradition that helps it happen. A person shouldn't speak that way. We don't say maybe something bad will happen. We don't even say if something bad would happen, like that Amora said to the other one. Told him, if this would happen to you, would you be behaving this way? And the Gemara says that helped it happen. So Yaakov's claim was, you know what? I'm not concerned something bad will happen with him specifically, but every time you guys left, something bad happened. Every time I leave the brothers together, I lose one. So I can't let Binyamin go with you guys. What's going to happen? That's one possible answer. Yosef reveals himself to the brothers and he starts crying. And he asks them, is my father still alive? Seems like he didn't believe them beforehand. He knew they were talking under pressure. So he says, now that you know who I am, tell me the truth. Is my father still alive? Yosef tells them, don't feel bad that you sold me down here, because God sent me before you as sustenance for all of you. The question is, how do we understand this? There were two famous people who lived a little bit before Rashi, Dunash ben Mabrat and Menachem ben Saruk. Rashi quotes them often. They were grammaticians. And they compiled works. Menachem ben Saruk compiled the Machberet, a notebook in which he writes what's the root of each word, and Dunash ben Labrat compiled his work. And there were bitter arguments between the two of them, and Rashi quotes them more in Tehillim and in other books of Tanakh, but also in Torah, when Menachem quotes Menachem or Machberet Menachem, that's who he's quoting. And I think it was Dunash ben Labrat who, I might be getting it backwards, but I'm speaking, Dunash ben Labrat was hired by a wealthy one of the wealthy leaders of the community to compile different poetic works. And at one point, they told this Muslim leader, they told him that Dunash ben Labrat had been joining forces with those who were conspiring against him. And this Muslim leader sent his troops Shabbos morning to Dunash's home, and they destroyed his home, beat him up, pulled out all the hairs of his beard, and left his home in ruins. And Dunash wrote a letter to this leader, and he told him, I don't understand why you did this to me. Why do you believe the bad things that people say about me? I have always been faithful to you. In my hardest times, you sent me requests to write a poem in commemoration of your relative's death. I wrote it. I was always faithful to you, and I've never done anything wrong. Why'd you do this to me? And this leader sent him back a letter. He said, you know what? Maybe you were faithful, maybe you weren't. If you really were faithful, and you didn't really do me the harm that they say you did, then be happy. I brought you one step closer in Olam Haba. I removed more sin from you. And if you really were improper in your behavior, so I paid you back for what you did. So this is quoted as one of the most disgusting statements that were ever said. Because any person could do someone else harm, and they say, don't feel bad, I brought you closer to your Creator, I removed sin from you. You suffered a little bit more harm in this world, you'll get more in the world to come. That's not a way a person can behave. And so the question is, what is Yosef telling his brothers? God sent me before you. So the Rambam in Mor Nevuchim addresses this question. It's not that Yosef was removing all responsibility from his brothers. It's not that Yosef was saying, you know, God has a godly plan. I was meant to be down here. So you guys are okay. Fine. You sold me. Fine. I spent 21 years, 10 years in prison. So it's okay. There was a godly plan. But rather, Yosef is saying in retrospect, we do understand that there was a godly plan and there was a purpose, and things are working out the way they should. Whether they should have sold him or not, they have to worry about that. But from his perspective, he's saying, God wanted me down here. I'm here to save you guys, to save the family. Which shows a difference in perspective. When Yosef was young, he was 17 years old, he was telling the brothers, guys, I have a dream. You're all bowing. I'm in the middle. That's one perspective. Now he's grown up. He's paid a price in order to attain this position of leadership. And he recognizes that this position is not for his honor, but rather he is a public servant. He's here to serve them. The Chassam Sofer asks a philosophical question. He says, who's the most important person in the world? The most important person in the world is the farmer. He's the one that really gives us the grain, he gives us the food. He's really the one important in the world. But the farmer knows that if there won't be some law, some enforcement, that when he tries to sell his grain, people are going to rob him, people are going to steal his equipment. So all the farmers get together and they say, we need some kind of government, so we'll appoint some kind of servant. He's going to be a policeman. But they know that this policeman needs someone above the policeman to decide what the laws are and the rules, so they say, we'll have a servant for these servants, and he's going to be the judge. And they know that they need someone to decide what public policy is for the land, so they say, we'll have someone else who's serving us, a servant for the servant for the servant, he's going to be the governor. And they know that all the farmers of the different cities, they need someone on top of them, so they say, you know what, we'll have a servant for the servants for the servants that will serve us, that'll be the king. So he says the king is really one big fat servant, he's a servant to all the servants, and the governor's a servant, and the judge is a servant, and the police are all servants. Everyone's really here serving the farmer, because the farmer is the one that's really sustaining, and he wants all these servants. So then the Chassam Sofer says, then how come is it, the Chassam Sofer asks, how come is it that the farmer everyone looks down upon, and everyone looks up to the king, but he's just one big servant? So the question is perspective. The king is one enforcing, so he's got the power. But his job is really representative of the fact that he's a public servant. The question is, does he perceive it that way? Ordinarily not. Yosef does perceive it that way. Yosef says, guys, I'm here for you. God sent me down here to support the family. And this is what allows Yosef not to hate his brothers. The fact that Yosef can recognize there's a purpose. God sent me down here because I'm supposed to save the world, really. He doesn't say that to the brothers. I'm supposed to help the family. When we encounter difficult things in life, we could focus on the doer, we could focus on the person and say, what a terrible person that is. And that'll be very frustrating. Very often we can't do anything about that. Or we could focus on the challenge and say, what does God have in mind for me? One of my rabbeim, Rabbi Avraham Ort, has a motto in life that stems from this parsha. He says, when we view life, we can take things very seriously, and to an extent we have to take things seriously. We could look at the troubles we have in life and say, how am I ever going to get out of this? How is this ever going to work? And at the same time, we could look at things and say, there's a guiding hand here. Let's take two steps back. They're standing before the most powerful person in the world. He controls all the food in the world at this time, and he's telling them, you guys are spies. Starts looking bad. They're standing before this most powerful man in the world, and he says, I'm taking into custody one of your brothers, and I don't want to see your face again without the little one. Things are looking worse. They're on their way home, and suddenly they have the money back. How are they ever going to face him again? They're going to claim they stole the money. They never paid for the goods. Things are looking even worse. The father says, I don't want to send the little one. They're starting to run out of food. They leave their families and they come back to Egypt. And now this man calls them into their palace. Uh-oh, what does he want? He says, don't feel bad. He wants to party with you. He feels bad what you guys went through. He wants to give you a special dinner. So they eat with him. And the next morning, things are starting to look a little bit brighter. They're all united, heading back to the land of Israel. When suddenly the troops catch up with them and they say, you thieves, they catch the goblet, they bring him back and they say, we're taking the little one, they have no choice. He's a thief. What are they going to do? They know their father is going to die if he doesn't see Binyamin. He won't be able to handle it. Things are looking as bad as they could look. And with three words, the whole situation looks differently. When Yosef says, Ani Yosef Achichem, I am Yosef, your brother, when he says those three words, suddenly the whole situation looks differently. Ah, it was all a game. He was playing with us. Really, he's our brother. He loves us. He doesn't want to take our brother into custody. He doesn't want to harm us. He wants what's best for us. He's been playing a game with us. He's trying to teach us something. With those three words, their understanding of the whole scenario changes. Their understanding of the whole previous months, everything they've gone through, now looks different. That's the world we live in. Sometimes we think, like, everything's bad. How could this turn out good? How could something good come out of this? We have to remember that at any given moment, things could look differently. The question is, will we merit that? But the situation itself does not warrant us giving up. I think it was the Rebbe of Biyan who gave a speech in Auschwitz the year before they were redeemed. And it was Yom Kippur evening. And he said, when we stand here and we offer whatever prayer we're going to offer tonight, we have to ask ourselves, how many times did we behave improperly here in custody, here in Auschwitz? And I don't mean, he said, how many times did we look at the smoke coming out of the chambers and say, when will I finally be in smoke? I don't mean how many times we wanted to give up. I don't mean how many times we asked ourselves, why am I here? I mean, how many times did we look at our situation and ask, and not remember? How many times did we allow ourselves to forget that at any given moment God could change the situation? It's known that there was another Rebbe that told his disciples, he said, you have to believe that at any given moment the situation could change. And, our principal in elementary school used to tell this story every year, that I don't remember who the Rebbe was. He told the students, you have to believe that every moment it can change. And they heard the American troops approaching, and the Germans said, we're not leaving you alive. And they gathered them, and they brought them out to the firing squad. They said, we might lose the war if you guys aren't coming out alive. And one student turned to the Rebbe and he said, we're standing here, they're pointing the guns at us. Do you still say at every given moment we have to believe the situation can change? He said, of course. And at that very moment, a tank rolled in, an American tank, that happened to get lost. Lost ranks with all the other tanks. It was a soldier that didn't know what he was doing. But when he rolled in, the firing squad picked up their hands and surrendered. And they were safe. This is a true story. They were safe that moment. They were about to be shot, all of them, and they were safe. So the brothers are standing here before Yosef, and that's one of the lessons of Jewish history. Never give up. We never know when everything can change, and everything did change. Yosef tells them, look, I'm in charge. Rush up to our father and tell him that this is what Yosef says. I'm responsible for Egypt. I want you to come down. Don't detain yourself. And you'll live here in Goshen. Why is Yosef calling Yaakov down to Egypt? Yosef has a problem. Yosef would like to send his father all the food in the world out to the land of Israel. But Yosef knows that if he starts exporting tremendous amounts of food to his home territory, to Israel, the Egyptians are going to say he's amassing wealth in Israel. They're going to suspect him that he's purposely sending a lot of food out to Israel, selling it in Israel, and keeping the money, starting to build his empire out in Israel. So he tells his father, I can't support you out in Israel. I can't do that. I could only support you if you're here. I could give you as much food as you want free. But I can't send food out to the land of Israel free because they're not going to let me do that here in Egypt. This is the second year. 2 years have passed from the famine. So Yosef says, you guys have to come down here and I'll support the whole family. I'll get you the land of Goshen, which is good farmland, which is good grazing land, I'm sorry. And it's not far from me, and I'll be able to support the family. Paro hears that Yosef's brother is king. And Paro is very happy, because until now Paro had a problem. The law in Egypt forbade appointing a servant. So Paro tried legally to exonerate Yosef retroactively for everything he did. But still, no one knew where Yosef was coming from. And we had pointed out at the beginning of this story that we have to see the correlations between this story and the story of Purim. And this is another correlation, where we see Yosef, no one knew his history, no one knew his family, and really he came from royal family, from Yaakov. And so to Esther, in the story of Purim, no one knew her family. When they found out, they knew, oh, she comes from a royal family, she comes from the family of King Saul. Paro knows that he has a very trusted person, Yosef. And Paro knows that Yosef will not take a penny from his wealth in order to help his family. So Paro tells Yosef, he tells him, you tell your brothers, load up the donkeys with food, bring as much food as you can back home, go back to the land of Canaan, and bring the families back down here to Egypt and enjoy the fat of the land. I'm commanding you, Paro tells Yosef, take wagons to bring the families back to Egypt. Why does Paro have to command him? One understanding is because Paro knows how faithful Yosef is. Yosef won't allow himself to take from the royal money to bring his family in. Another understanding is that we know the Gemara mentions that Egypt had exceptionally good agalim, cats. As the Navi says, and the Egyptians were scared. They didn't want people to compete with them. Just like today, there's a major producer of grain that's trying to genetically alter their grain so that no one will be able to plant it and grow grain again. And you could grow one harvest from the grain, but the grain that grows, you won't be able to plant again. That way they avoid competition, only their grain. Well, they have control of more than 25% of the world market, so people don't have so much choice. So too in Egypt, they were very concerned. They didn't want competition. The Gemara records that they had guards along the borders of Egypt, and you couldn't leave Egypt with a calf without their removing the uterus, so the calf would never be able to become pregnant. So they would sell you a calf, but on condition that it could not become pregnant. And Yosef would not do that. We know that Judaism forbids us to neuter animals, to do things like this. So Yosef wouldn't take calves and send them up to his father. So Paro tells him, don't worry, I know you got this strange thing, you don't want us to do this to the uterus of an animal. You take the calves, I give you special permission, and send them the way you want to your father. That's one understanding. Another understanding is that Egypt would not allow a calf to leave Egypt without carving on the calf or on the wagon their idol worship. And Yosef didn't want to do that. Yosef didn't believe in his idol worship. So Paro told him, okay, for you are making an exception, you send up the wagons the way you want, with the calves the way you want. If you recall, when Yosef had left his father had taught him an important rule. His father had taught him that you have to accompany a person. You don't let a person leave alone. When a person leaves, you do levaya, you accompany him part of the way, you take care that he has what he needs for the way. And now Yosef wants to give word to his father that he's still alive. So Yosef sends back these wagons, and agalot is like egla hufat, like that halacha that the Torah teaches us, that when a person leaves the city, if we find him dead, he was murdered, so we have to bring a special calf to do a whole procession to show that we did our best to find who the murderers are and to ensure that this person would arrive safely at his destination. We did give him what he needed when he traveled, and those were the halachas that Yaakov had taught Yosef when he left. So now Yosef wants to show him that he's still alive, so he sends him these wagons to accompany him down to Egypt as a sign, hey Dad, I remember the lesson you taught me, you accompany a person, you help him out. Paro sends word to Yaakov, he says, don't worry about the little vessels, I know you, your family, that you don't waste a penny, because you don't steal a penny, you don't waste a penny, because you know how precious a penny is. So this time I'm asking you, I'm giving you all the goods of the land of Egypt, come quickly, don't worry about the little things. Paro knows he will gain. Paro knows how much he gained from having Yosef. And Pharaoh's interest is to ensure that Yosef remains and his family remains. Pharaoh's interest is having the royal family of Yaakov come to his land. He knows we'll gain from it.
Well, you're talking about not being able to
do
it earlier
above
those that live in your house.
Also, not supposed to do it. Torah says we'll learn. It's in the Torah. Now, I don't know if today there are ways which are halakhically permitted. I don't know how far science has advanced. Maybe there are ways today that are halakhically permitted. I don't know of any ways. As far as I know, not, but I don't know. I didn't do enough research. What? It has been done. What can you do? What can you do? Now, if you recall, the brothers, when they saw that they were caught, so they all tore their clothing. So now Yosef gives them new clothing. He has to pay them back. He clothes them all to tear their clothing, so he pays them back. He gives them good clothing. And he gives Binyamin an extra gift. He gives him 300 silver coins and 5 clothing. One understanding is that Binyamin suffered. The brothers beat him up. He lost more than everyone else. Another understanding is that when you take a person as a slave illegally and you send him out to Chutz La'aretz, then the halacha is you have to repay him up to 10 times the value. You know, the value that the Torah gives us for a slave is 30 silver coins. Here Yosef was in the process of illegally taking Binyamin as a slave, so he had to pay him back up to 10 times the value that he took him. So he gave him the 300 silver coins. Why did he give him 5 suits? So that the Gemara discusses. One understanding is that he erred. He followed in his father's footsteps, just like his father erred, that he showed favoritism, so to Yosef over here erred. But the Gemara tries to rectify it. The Gemara not tries, the Gemara does rectify it. The Gemara says that here was an allusion to the future, what would happen with Binyamin's offspring, with Mordechai. Yosef was alluding to what would be in the future. Look it up in the Gemara and Megillah. And he sends his father donkeys laden with the goods of Egypt. And he tells them, Al tirgezu badarech. One understanding is, don't fight over whose fault it was that this whole thing happened. You set to sell him, you set to kill him, you said like this. No, don't fight about it. It's history. Another understanding is, he told them, don't delve into halacha. I was once walking from my house to high school, and the Rebbe of mine stopped by to give me a ride. And he saw me learning. So he said, what are you learning for? I said, what do you mean? It says in the Torah of Lech Chabader, you're supposed to learn while you walk. So he said, yeah, but you can't delve into your learning while you're traveling, because then it's not safe. You could get run over, you could could walk into a pit. You can't do that. You want to learn while you're going. If you're in a wagon and someone's driving it, yeah, then you should learn in depth while you're traveling. If you're sitting on a plane, you could learn in depth. Someone else is driving the plane, someone else is driving the car. You're walking along the road, and you have to look where you're going, so don't learn in depth. And this is what Yosef is telling the brothers. You guys are traveling. You can't go in depth into halacha now. You guys would feel, maybe we should go study. Maybe what we did to Yosef was proper, wasn't proper. Let's go review that halacha. Let's go into learning in depth. No, that's not your job now. You're traveling. Focus on the road. And this is something which I often tell chassanim. Whenever I meet a guy who's a chassan, I tell him, buddy, your head isn't here. When you cross the street, look both ways 3 times. You remember when you were 3 years old, your mother taught you how to cross the street? Well, that's how you should cross the street now, because almost every chassan I know, his head is in the cloud. We have to know when we're preoccupied. So here the brothers, we're going to be preoccupied with something else. But we have to know in life that there are times that we are preoccupied. And it could be because someone has an exciting thing coming up. Maybe a person has his gear coming up. Maybe a person has a date coming up. Maybe a person has an engagement coming up. Maybe a person is engaged and he's about to get married. Every husband I told this to leaned over and said, shh, you know how right you are. I almost got killed, but no one knows about it. Every husband I told this to already told me, everyone, this is 100% so far, has told me, you know, the truth is, you're 100% right. I almost got run over already, but I'm not telling anyone. So, guys, listen to me when you're chassanim. Remember this, Al tirgezu badarech. Don't focus on your learning when you're traveling. Don't focus on your girl when you're traveling. If you have to cross the street, stop, look both ways, and be careful when you cross the street. They leave Mitzrayim and they come to Canaan. And the Midrash says, they said, how are we going to tell Yaakov Yosef's still alive? How are we going to do this? So Asher had a stepdaughter named Serach. She's called Serach Bas Asher, But really she was from a different father, according to one tradition. So Sarah, they sent her in advance, and she went to play a musical instrument. She sat there before Yaakov playing the instrument, and he started singing a song. And every few lines she'd say, "And Yosef is still alive." And eventually Yaakov hears her and he says, "Stop singing that silly song." And she'd laugh and she'd start playing the song again, and then at some point she'd hit the line again, "Yosef's still alive." And Yaakov says, "Why are you saying that?" She says, "Who knows, maybe he's still alive." And she sent them in advance and she slowly broke the news to him. And even so, when the brothers came and tried to tell him, he couldn't believe him. He fainted. And they started giving him all the signs that Yosef gave them, and when he saw the wagon and the sign, Yosef said, "That's the last halacha you taught me, that you have to accompany a person when he leaves you." So then his spirit came back and he blessed her. He blessed Achbas Asher to live a very long life. And here we have a medrash that says she was around in the time the Jews left Egypt 210 years later, and she was the one that revealed to the Jewish people that when Moshe came along and said, "God sent me," so the Jews said, "How do we know you're not a fake?" There was a man by the name of Nun who came and said, "Time for the Jews to leave Egypt," and the tribe of Ephraim followed him, and they all got killed. He was a fake. "How do we know you're not a fake?" So he said, "Find out. I'm telling you, I have a sign. God told me. Here are the words God told me." And they went to Sarah Bas Asher, and she had a tradition going back to Yosef, what the Redeemer would really say, and she said, "Yeah, he's not a fake. He's telling the truth." So Sarah was an old lady who everyone came to for advice. How long she lived? So that's a good question. Yaakov blessed her to live an exceptionally long life. Those who say she's still around today, who knows? There are those who say she never passed away. I wouldn't know. Huh? No, I don't know. When I was a kid, they told me she's still alive. I don't know.
It's true. They don't know who she
is. Let's put it this way. Either I don't know or I'm not willing to tell. But I will tell you that I don't know. So Yosef says, so Yaakov says, Yaakov sees the wagon. And there's an ancient tradition that says that in the Sefer Torah, when it says, "Vayaret ha'agalot," when he saw the wagons, the ayin is written raised a little bit. So it would be as though it would say, "Vayaret ha'agalot," with the ayin stuck in. And the tradition has it that when Yaakov saw the wagons, Yaakov saw the galus. Vayaret ha'agalot, without an ayin, is vayaret ha'galut. He saw the galus. Sometimes it looks like someone's giving us a gift. And really, what he's giving us is problems. There's a more vulgar way of saying it, but I think it's something worth remembering. Someone once said, when someone shakes your hand, you don't know how many germs he has on his hands. Maybe he just came out of the bathroom and didn't wash his hands. So he seems to be doing something very nice. He's giving you a handshake. But maybe he's giving you a ton of germs as he's shaking your hands. We always have to be prepared when we look at actions that are done. We have to see them on the surface and we have to see beyond the surface. Yaakov sees the wagon. He sees there's abundance. He sees there's wealth. He sees there's an invitation to Egypt. His son is running the land. What could be better? He's going to be supported. He sees gullus. He sees what's hiding behind the wagon.
How long did he see it for?
He knows that the 400 years that were promised, that we'd be in exile, that we'd be in servitude, they're about to begin. And truth, we know that they began earlier. Yaakov had hoped he would be able to do his time, so to speak, in the land of Canaan. And when he sees those wagons, he's contemplating, should I go or not? And he goes to Be'er Sheva, which is the place where his forefathers had prophetic visions. And he brings for the first time a zeva. Until Yaakov, the sacrifices that were brought were ola. The forefathers all brought sacrifices that were totally burned. And Yaakov has attained the level now that he sees that his tribes are reunited. Now that he sees that the Jewish people can flourish the way he had expected. And can continue, he's on the level that he can bring a shlamim, a carbon that represents wholeness. The shlamim is a sacrifice which only Jews bring, sacrifice which is partially given to Hashem, partially to the Kohanim, and partially the owner eats. It's a sacrifice that represents a wholeness between man and his creator. And that's the sacrifice that Yaakov brings. God appears to Yaakov in a vision that night, and he tells him, "Yaakov, Yaakov, Notice that he is not called Yisrael. He is called the name of a lower level. The name that represents the Jewish people when they are low. And he tells them, I want you to know, do not fear. I will be with you even when you are on your lowest level. Even when you are at the level of Yaakov, I, the God of your forefathers, will be with you. Do not fear going down to Mitzrayim. That is where you will become great. Yaakov was scared. He's going down to a land where he knows that there's rampant incest, improper relationships. How could he bring his families down? The first thing he does is shiduchim. Says everyone that wants, that's coming down has to be married. He pairs up even the little one. He says no one's coming down to Egypt without a wife. That's number one. He asks God, and God tells him, don't worry. The Jewish people will remain different. They will maintain their own language. They will maintain their own dress. They will come out a great nation. They won't intermarry. After getting this assurance, Yaakov goes down. We have a tradition that Yaakov could have gone down in shackles. Because of Yaakov's merit, because Yaakov was on such a high level, God did him this favor that he went down in this kind fashion. He went down with an entourage. He went down with the greeting, Yosef is the king. But in truth, the 210 years are about to begin. Yaakov takes his family down. He realizes that. He realizes that full well. When he sees those wagons, he knows what's happening. They take all their wealth and they go down to Egypt. Here we have an enumeration of the family. And before Yaakov comes down to Egypt, he sends Yehuda. This is a rule. Rabbi Wein pointed out that our stay in different countries was fashioned by who led the way. When we were exiled to Babylon, God did us a favor that prior to the major exile, there was a more minor exile. The Babylonian king wanted to ensure that we wouldn't rebel. He took all the leaders out of Israel. He took all the rabbis, all the leaders, exiled them to Babylon. He thought he was going to ensure that we don't rebel again in the land of Israel. We did rebel. But what he did was a great favor for us. Because by the fact that the leaders were exiled first, they established yeshivas. When the exile came to Babylon, when the majority of the Jewish people came to Babylon, at that point they came to Babylon and they found the communities established by the rabbis. When the Jews came back to Israel, so we had Ezra, we had leadership of Torah. When the Jews came to the United States, the ones that led the way were the conservative movement. And that was a problem. That was a problem. So each exile was fashioned by that. Very often when we look at a place to live in, we think of, how far is it from my work? Is there people who I could mingle with, my wife could mingle with? When in truth, one of the, if not the most major thing we should consider is what are the educational institutions for our children? Because this is what will fashion our family. And that's what Yaakov knows. Therefore Yaakov, before coming down to Egypt, sends Yehuda in advance. He tells him, you set up educational institutions, you set up yeshivas, so that when we come down there, our children can continue learning Torah. When people consider where they live, that should be the major consideration. Sometimes it's worth traveling to one's job and having the correct educational institution for one's children. People who forego that very often are foregoing the Jewish continuum of their family. Unfortunately, we see it all the time. We see all the time people who go to live in different areas, and areas where it might be a more affluent community, there might be all kinds of perks to those who live there, but they don't have the education that they want, and they pay the price. What's more precious than one's children? Yosef has respect. He goes out to greet his father. Very often guys come to me and tell me, you know, my parents are coming to Israel. I ask them, when are you going to see them? They say, 2 days after they land. And I always think that's improper. You see, Yosef was king. He was a busy person. He stopped his life when his father came down to Egypt. He took his horse and buggy and went out to greet his father. Your parents come, you have to go and greet them. I don't think it's right that people let their parents come to the airport and they're not there to give them a helping hand. Even if their parents don't need their help, it's different. Someone comes out to greet you. Yaakov didn't need Yosef to come out to greet him. Yaakov had his whole family there. Could have managed just fine. But Yosef had respect. He went out to greet his father. We have tradition that when Yosef came to greet his father was in the middle of saying Shema Yisrael. And so Yosef is coming and Yaakov doesn't say a word. He's in the middle of speaking to his creator. Yosef tells his brothers, I'm going to go tell Paro that you guys came. And I'm going to tell him that you're shepherds because I don't want him to take you into his political arena. He's going to try to hire you. He's going to try to make you generals. And you guys are better off staying together. And that's something to remember. Sometimes it's important to have Jews in politics, but we have to know that there's a heavy price when you enter politics. And Yosef knew that if he could keep his brothers out of it, he's doing them the best favor. And that's what he does. Second, he tells them they're shepherds, and he takes his brothers that are least impressive to stand before Pharaoh's, and takes a sampling, but he takes the least impressive, so that Pharaoh won't take them in. And it works. And they tell Pharaoh, we came here, we're visiting. We don't have where to graze our cattle, so we came, let us stay in Goshen, and we want to leave. But Pharaoh has other plans. The land of Goshen, we have tradition that Pharaoh gave that as a gift to Sarah, to their matriarch, when he took her in improperly. So then he said, I apologize, it was wrong what I did, I'm giving you the land of Goshen as a gift. So they all situated in that land, and that's why one understanding says Pharaoh told Yosef, Avicha ve'echecha bo eilecha, your father and brother came to you. Pharaoh was saying, hey, I'm not responsible for these guys, they're your family. You want to take care of them, you do it out of your own pocket. So he puts them in the land of Goshen, which is what he had originally intended, which is a land that they own, the family owned. Yaakov comes before Paro, and Paro asks him, old man, how old are you? So what, that's the way to speak. So one understanding is, what a chutzpah guy this is. That's how he speaks to an old man. We have tradition that Paro was a very short man. Paro was an arm's length, a tiny midget. And Paro made the entrance to his chambers, the place where he met people. I don't know. Pharaoh had the entrance to his room be a very low entrance, so that whoever entered would have to enter bowing down. And when our forefathers came to Pharaoh, so God made a miracle, and the entrance got bigger, and they walked straight in. When Rav Mordechai Eliyahu went to the Vatican to meet the Pope, he came to the door and he found that the door was a very low doorway. With the same intent, they wanted that when he walks in, he'll bow down to the Pope. So he walked in backwards. When Yaakov comes before Paro, so Paro, as a youngster, his father had sent him to Avimelech to learn. This was something that was done. Each one would send his child to a different king to be educated. So Paro had seen Yaakov's father Yitzchak as a kid, and now he sees Yaakov, who looks similar to Yitzchak, and he thinks it's the same person. He looks so similar, he says, you're around since then? How old are you, old man? So Yaakov says, no, I'm not such an old man. I said, I'm only 130 years old. Another understanding is that when Yaakov comes before Paro, Yaakov tells him, he says, look, I want to be buried after the famine, when everything's over. I want to go back to the land of Israel to be buried. And if you're willing to let me do that, good. If not, I'll buy grain and I'm going back. And Paro told him, you look like such an old man. You think you're going to live out the famine? And after the famine, you're going to be buried back in the land of Israel? How old are you? At which point Yaakov tells him, no, I'm only 130 years old, but I've suffered so much through my life that I look old. Sages say that certain things can cause a person to have a lot of white hairs. Now, what a person goes through, a person's wife, a person's children, different sorts that a person can go through, the Medrash says, can cause them to have white hairs. There's a famous joke that a kid asks his father, he tells him, Dad, why do you have white hairs? He says, every time you annoy me, I get another white hair. So the kid tells his father, now I understand why Grandpa has all white hairs.
My mom says that she gets a gray hair every time we stand, every time we go missing.
Okay, so her search is in the Medrash. The Medrash Tampuma says that. Could be, I guess. Yosef sustains them, and when Yosef collects the taxes, so he ultimately ends up acquiring all the wealth in Egypt, all the property. all the cattle. Because they had to sell everything in trying to acquire food from him. And the land of the Kohanim he left behind. Why does the Torah mention this? So the Torah mentions this. Moshe wrote it in the Torah to teach us not to be skimpy. That here Paro gave his priests that really they were worthless. They didn't. The only reason Paro kept them was so that they would support his myth, his lie that he himself was a god. So Paro had to deal with them. I'll help you, you help me. I'll give you money, you guys keep telling the people that I control the Nile, that I created myself. And still, nonetheless, Yosef did give them a fifth. Yosef did give them the land, and he exonerated them from the fifth, the tax. And the Torah is telling us that when the Torah tells us that we should give land to the Kohanim, and we should give a fifth to the Kohanim, we shouldn't think badly of it, because here we're doing a true mitzvah, and God gave us the land of Israel. Really, God owns the land, and God gave it to us, so certainly if God tells us to give the Kohanim the land and give them a fifth, we shouldn't be skimpy. The Torah tells us that when the people ran all out of money, so Yosef made a deal with them. He said, 25% I get and 75% you get. And this teaches us that a person, when he spends on a mitzvah, he should spend up to 25%. 75% is always important to hold on to. And Yosef knew that also, so he told them, you guys hold on to 75%. You guys work the field, so 75% you keep. 25% I keep. The Torah ends the parasha by telling us that the Jews lived in the land of Mitzrayim and Goshen. They started succeeding and flourishing. As the Midrash states, that wherever the Jews go, they are like oil, that they rise to the top. And we know what happens when they rise to the top. That's when anti-Semitism flourishes as well. So that's what we will see in 2 weeks in Parsha Shmos, that the Egyptians start looking around and saying, hey, wait a second, these guys are taking over, they are a threat.